Well, in corrections, evidence-based might be the most popular phrase that nobody agrees on. If a program has a study, any study, it's evidence-based. If it feels right, it's evidence-based. If it's been around a long time, it is definitely evidence-based. But here are some awkward follow-up questions we don't often ask. How strong is the evidence? And even if a program works, is it worth what it costs? Today, we're talking about what it actually means for a corrections program to be evidence-based and why effectiveness alone isn't the finish line. Because in the real world, good intentions don't balance budgets, and outcomes without cost only tell half the story. This is Pracademically Speaking, where research meets the real world. Well, hello. Welcome to Pracademically Speaking, a conversation where ideas and numbers get real. Today, we're having a discussion with Dr. Brett Buckland, Director of the Bureau of Planning, Research, and Statistics at the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. We're having a conversation today about what it means for corrections policy to be evidence-based. Dr. Buckland, welcome back to your studio.
Thanks.
Good to have you. All right, let's start. When people in corrections say a program is evidence-based, what should they actually mean, and what does it often mean in practice?
Yeah, so the starting point is how we know what we know in corrections, or really anything. And so the lowest level of knowledge would be intuition. Above that would be experiential knowledge. So we have a lot of staff that have good experiential knowledge, a lot of background and expertise just based on their experience. And then above that would be science. And we very rarely get to the point of mathematical proof, but science is a better way of understanding what works, what has evidence behind it, and what doesn't. So that should be the measure of evidence-based. It should mean that a program has credible, methodologically sound evidence that it causes, and that word causes is important. We've talked about causality versus correlation on the podcast before. We'll probably talk about that again, but that the program causes better outcomes than would have occurred without it. So it needs to be causal evidence, consistent, not just one study. It needs to have a meaningful impact. It needs to be credible. It can't be something that just can work in a laboratory. It has to work in the real world. So all those things make up what we call evidence-based practices. What it often means, what it actually often means in practice, in reality, is that it's something that's popular. It's something that someone can find at least one study to support it. Or we get a lot of vendors or contractors that try to sell us programs, and they're saying, oh, this is an evidence-based program. So it's almost like it's a sales pitch, something that vendors will use, or anecdotal evidence, cherry-picked evidence from a handful of select studies, or a marketing scheme to kind of label. Because if you put that label evidence-based on it, it's hard to say, well, I don't believe in evidence.
Sure.
So it becomes like a, something that everyone – puts on something to sell their program.
You picked on vendors. Who else gets the evidence base? Who else confuses kind of gut instinct, personal experience, anecdote for evidence base?
I think the public does. Certainly, politicians do that a lot, where they conflate anecdotal evidence or cherry picked evidence from other jurisdictions with something being evidence based. And the consequence of calling something evidence-based when it's really not evidence-based is that we can oversell the benefit of a program. And so what the research has shown a lot is that when you look at weaker research, that it tends to exaggerate the impact that a program will have. So you'll hear grandiose claims like this program cuts recidivism in half, or my program has a 5% recidivism rate. And so everyone invests a lot into that program thinking that, oh, this is an evidence-based practice, when it was really based on some very thin research. And so when you start to do the research more rigorously, you find that very modest effect sizes, usually very modest impacts of programs.
Before we move on, I want to stay with this. The idea of somebody's story as truth or personal experience as truth, is that – I mean – story drives a great deal of public policy. How do you combat that?
I think it's because everyone has a story. And so an anecdote or a sample size of one in a vacuum does not mean that that's representative of what actually is going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, everyone's got a perspective, everyone's got a story, but you collect evidence, you collect multiple stories. In a way, data and science is just multiple stories collected together and quantified. And so you're taking a lot of stories and quantifying them.
So let's compare the story to the study. There's always this saying that hangs out there that you can find a study to prove almost anything. There's a poll for that.
Yep.
There's a study for that. When that's true, how should correctional leaders and policymakers separate, make this dividing line between credible evidence from convenient evidence?
Right, right. And what that really gets at is how to become a good consumer of research or science. Often when people say, you can find a study to prove everything, what they're really trying to do is undermine the reliability of research or science. When, you know, the reality is it matters whether it's a good quality study or a weak study. So some of the mistakes that are made often is I've heard, well, there are 100 studies that show X. But 99 of those 100 studies might be very poorly done studies. There was a journal article in Corrections that had the title, literally in the title of the article, it said, can 14,737 women be wrong? And the answer is yes. Just because, you know, there's a lot of studies on something doesn't mean that the studies are any good. The quality of it matters, not just the quantity is what I'm trying to say.
And there's kind of a form now. You just named one, but there's a form almost to every kind of policy argument where you can kind of insert your argument here, your
right.
number, your formula.
Right, right. And then, you know, to come back to causality, that's the other thing that, you know, most studies don't do a great job of establishing causality or what we call causal inference.
How about plain language on that?
Okay, so... and again, I think we've probably covered it on the podcast before, but difference between causality and correlation. So a couple examples. People observe that ice cream sales go up at the same time the number of drownings go up. But no one's saying that ice cream sales leads to drowning. It's because both of those happen in the summer. People are swimming and they're ordering ice cream. Another one, that larger shoe size is related to reading levels in elementary school. Why might that be?
Why?
Because the older kids have larger shoe size and they're more mature in their reading level. It doesn't mean that the shoe size is causing them to have better reading levels. Another one is that more Boy Scouts leads to lower delinquency rates. But again, the kind of people that become Boy Scouts probably weren't going to be delinquents in the first place. There's something about them that wants to achieve. So that's a spurious.
They were Boy Scouts at heart to begin with.
Right. And then remember the old... stork brings the baby thing, right? So you know how that started?
Wait, is this not a
this,
fact?
You know, the whole birds
storks?
And bees discussion, and everyone talked about the storks bringing the baby. Well, that started in Europe because they found that towns that had more storks also had a higher birth rate. But what it was because they were more populous, there was more places for the storks to land, more houses. And of course, because it was more populous, there were more babies, too.
You blow my mind, Brett.
So, anyways, those are all examples of the difference. That's why just because two things correlate together or go together doesn't mean that one causes the other. And what we're really trying to do in evidence-based policymaking is say program or policy or practice X causes result Y.
Okay, so that kind of shifts it into a very practical question. How do you handle a situation then where there is not an evidence base for a program or a policy?
Yeah.
It's already in place. They've followed the stories and the anecdotes and the old wives' or husbands' tales, or a situation where the ideal program or evaluation approach cannot be done. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, let me first back up and keep – one more second on the last question, which is how do we know whether it's credible evidence or not? And so there's a couple of things that need to be established. One is, what is the research design used in the study? These are questions you should ask as a consumer if you're looking to see, is this really quality evidence? So one thing is this research design any good? Is it a randomized controlled trial, or is it less quality style of research? Do they have a comparison group? Do they have a group? So you have a group that's in treatment, but you want to compare that to a group that wasn't in treatment, and those two groups should look similar. That's the advantage of a randomized trial, is that you can randomly assign people to the treatment or control group. But if you're just looking at the treatment group and have no comparison, then you have no frame of reference. Mm-hmm. Is there a sufficient sample size? Going back to the anecdote, if you have a sample size of probably 10 people, that's too small, right? So mm-hmm. you want a large enough sample size. Was it locally evaluated in your jurisdiction? Because something might work somewhere else, but just because it works somewhere else doesn't mean it works in Pennsylvania. We have a different population, different sentencing laws, different context. So has it been evaluated in your local context? Has it been replicated? Is there a large enough size of the impact that it matters? I mean, maybe it only reduces recidivism by a half a percentage point. So these are some of the questions that you should ask if you're trying to evaluate, is the evidence base strong enough?
But with all due respect to the general audience across Pennsylvania listening to this, most people are not asking those questions, which right. leads to the fact that you have situations where the programs are not evidence-based, but they have been there's been a sufficient drumbeat. There's been some right. kind of public momentum. Legislators, policymakers are getting phone calls.
Yeah.
And somebody told a really good, compelling story.
Yeah.
So what do? You just
This will come back to something I'll probably say near the end, but you need someone that's kind of a broker of the science, a person that's your research advisor, a research director. If you're a correctional leader or someone in a leadership position, you need someone who can interpret this stuff because it is really complicated stuff. You need someone that can say, that can read the science and say, this is good science, this is bad science. Let me translate it into layman's terms and practical terms for you and explain what it says, explain whether it's good research, good evidence or not.
But then the leader is going to have to find a way to communicate to the broader audience right. or the narrow audience of decision makers.
But that's the role of that science advisor too, is to kind of do two-way translation. So translate technical stuff into layman's term to help the leader communicate that to the people that they need to communicate sure. to, but also then communicate back to the scientist what the needs of the leader are to say, here's what my boss needs. Here, can you research this? And so it's kind of two-way translation. But I want to go back to the the question you made about what happens when we don't have any evidence for a program or a situation where there's a program that we're already doing, but it hasn't been evaluated yet. And I would say that this is okay too, because we need room for innovation. If we think that we're only going to do, quote, evidence-based programs, we're going to limit ourselves. We're basically saying we know everything we need to know. And so let's limit to what we already have evidence on. But some things have not been evaluated yet. And so we want to innovate. And I like the term evidence-generating programs. So these mm-hmm. are programs that don't have evidence base behind them yet, but we set them up in a way that we can generate evidence for it. So I call those evidence-generating practices or evidence-generating programs. And what we should do is we should pilot test any new initiative rather than bring it to scale so that we can collect that evidence if we don't already have it, so we can collect that evidence and see if it's effective or not.
Dr. Buckland, it feels like a very high wall to climb. Let me just close this segment and ask, where do you start to convince your organization, to apply resources to the kinds of science-based evaluators needed for policymakers and decision makers to make those kinds of decisions?
I would start with the cost and the benefits, which I think is going to lead into after the break. I would say if we're investing in programs that have no evidence, we're wasting our money. And so as stewards of taxpayer money, we want to make sure that we're investing in programs and policies and practices that actually, in truth, have a return on investment, that actually produce results, not that we can sell that they produce results, but that actually, in fact, produce results.
That'll be the last word for this segment. We need to take a break. When we get back, we'll continue our discussion on evidence-based policymaking with Dr. Brett Buckland. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Pracademically Speaking, a production of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Please share or cite any of the guests or content you hear on this podcast, but do not alter the audio in any way. Check for resources or publications mentioned in this episode in the show notes. Now, back to the host.
All right, we're back with Dr. Brett Buckland discussing what it actually means that corrections policy is evidence-based. Let's talk about costs. Dr. Buckland, what is cost-benefit analysis and how does that factor into this discussion about evidence-based policymaking?
Yeah, so I often say that all public policy, at least implicitly, is cost-benefit analysis. And we just don't often see costs and benefits the same. So some people in criminal justice might weigh the cost on the offender more than the victim, and some people might weigh the cost on the victim more than the offender. But all public policy in any sphere of public policy is really weighing cost and benefits. It's a cost-benefit analysis.
That's a good point, yeah. Cost-benefit
analysis, all it is just weighing all of the costs and all of the benefits of any particular program or policy, stacking up those costs and benefits, and seeing what the return on investment is. So in the end, being able to say, for every dollar I spend on this, how many dollars am I going to get in return? Hopefully it's more than a dollar. If it's less than a dollar, you're losing out because you're spending a dollar and you're getting less than a dollar back. So there are a number of different costs that go into this. It's not just financial cost, but intangible costs, like the cost of a human life, the cost of victims. That's an intangible
cost. By the way,
that
argument in public policy debate is a frequent one. You cannot put a price on a life, right?
I mean, that's... Economists would say you could.
Right.
And that's what cost-benefit analysis is people have really tried to estimate what are these intangible costs. Cost avoidance is another one. So preventative maintenance on our prisons to avoid future prison construction is a cost avoidance. Or offering treatment programs to avoid recidivism, that's a cost avoidance. Sunk cost is another cost. So these are costs that we don't pay attention to because they've already occurred and they can't be recovered. Like constructing a prison that's a prison that's already been constructed. That cost money in the past, but that's a sunk cost because we're not building it again. We can't recover that cost that we sunk into that. So sunk cost would be another cost. Externalities, this is where it gets interesting. So these would be side effect costs that affect other people. So for instance, a lot of libertarians say, well, I should have the benefit of having freedom, for instance, like to gamble. And so there's a benefit to me of having the freedom to gamble. But the cost, the externality, or what we call economists would say is the negative externality, is the cost on my family if I lose all my income and they have to pick up the tab and all that. So that would be an example of what we call a negative externality. That's also a cost. And then opportunity cost is another cost. So that's the value of the next best alternative. For instance, a person who is incarcerated can't be out paying taxes or working or contributing to society because they're incarcerated. So that we're missing that opportunity. That's an opportunity cost that we're not able to realize because they're incarcerated. So opportunity costs are values of the next best alternative that's foregone because we're putting cost into another thing. So all of these are examples of cost. When you hear cost, people tend to just think about dollars and cents. But these are all types of costs that you have to try to quantify in a cost-benefit analysis to really quantify what is the cost and what is the benefit, what are the costs and what are the benefits of this program.
But if you're trying to stay evidence-based, how do you know which of those to pick, which forms of cost-benefit analysis to be consistent?
Well, it's not a matter of which one to pick. You're really trying to pick all of them. So you're trying to consider all of the costs.
From every angle.
Like when we did the medication-assisted treatment evaluation, and we looked at not only the cost of the drug, but the benefit of recidivism, quantifying that in terms of benefit in dollars and cents, quantifying recidivism reduction, quantifying the less overdose deaths. So really it's about stacking up all of those costs and benefits, not picking one, mm-hmm. but really trying to consider all of the costs and all of the benefits and then stacking those up.
We're going to wrap up now, okay. but I want to get one piece of advice to correctional leaders trying to decide whether a program, a policy, a practice is both evidence-based and worth the money. What would it
okay.
be?
Okay. So I'll give you one parting thought and 3 points. How about that?
Got it.
My advice would be this. First of all, don't just ask whether a program is evidence-based, but get behind under the hood there. And instead of asking whether it's evidence-based, ask about what is the evidence. Is it credible? Mm-hmm. Is it evidence on your population in your context? And does the cost justify it? Can you justify the cost? So this means looking beyond a label of evidence-based. You're asking how strong is the evidence? How transferable is the evidence? What's the return on investment? What are we giving up to fund this that we could have used to fund something else because we have finite resources? So the goal isn't to, you know, fund what sounds good or what even has been studied the most. It's to really invest in programs that produce meaningful outcomes related to the cost. And related to this, I would say my advice would be is pilot test every new initiative mm-hmm. that you do rather than bringing it to scale right away to the whole population. That gives you a chance to test it, to build that evidence, to see if it works before we just assume that the evidence is there, bring it to scale. And then lastly, I would say, back to the point I made before is, if I'm a correctional leader, I want a person I can go to. I want an advisor, a science advisor. Might just be one person. It doesn't have to be a whole research office like we're fortunate enough here in Pennsylvania to have, but it could just be one person that you can go to be an arbiter of the science, to be an advisor and say, here's the evidence behind this, and that person can advise you on that. So I think every corrections director, every corrections department should have someone like that that's being an arbiter of the evidence.
And if they can't find a science advisor, call you.
There right? you go.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Buckland, we're out of time today. We'll have to end it there. Thanks for walking us through this. It's, I think, an important service to the field to help clarify what it looks like to truly follow evidence-based decision-making. We'll be back in a few weeks with a brand new episode of Pracademically Speaking.
Thanks for listening. Check out Pracademically Speaking wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. This is the conversation where ideas and numbers get real, on the ground and in practice. Pracademically Speaking is a production of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections.